Okay, before we wrap it up, anybody have any last questions? Neil?
Ekagata kind of came into the picture, and I don't know if we really fully defined it, and I'm wondering what the distinction is between it and vitakka. They seem to have a focus aspect.
The ekagata, well, vitakka is the directed thought, so lifting, as Ajahn Chah described, sort of lifting up of thought, and ekagata is literally it means one pointed or coming to a point, unification. So that's what it implies or has the quality of providing a unification or a gathering together of the different faculties of the mind. So that all through each of the, say, the four jhanas, then the consistent thread is ekagata. There's a one-pointedness, a unification, a gathering together of all the different factors of mind. There's a settledness or a wholeness or unification that is happening.
I guess I was confused because I think I've often heard it defined as one-pointed focus of mind.
Yes.
Sounds a little more like vitakka.
That's exactly why I define it as I do, because I think the one pointed focus of mind is a bit too narrow, and I think a bit too cerebral, in the sense of it's, you know, my mind honing in on something, whereas a unification is a much more settling, a gathering together of the qualities of mind. There's a harmony of the factors of mind. There's a balance in that.
I'll probably understand it better when I get there.
That's a great idea. Yeah, that's a great way to do it. Yes, Nick.
Could you also say that it's expansive? Would that be correct?
Expansive. Yes, that's a good...
Because I think, yeah. I was confused before, I thought it was like very, very narrow. And
yes.
But actually,
yes.
It's that, more like unified on the, yeah, the totality.
Yes, that's actually a very good distinction. So that there's an expansive quality, and I think that's also maybe that is saying that where you have a solid base for something, then there's a stability there, and so it's that unification or that gathering together that provides a stability. Great.
It reminds me when they talk about, say, finding that unified theory of the universe, how the universe works or something like that. On the one hand, it has this feeling of expansive, like it explains everything.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, seeing gives it feeling being very simple.
Yeah. I think that's probably a good way of looking at it. Yeah, Harry.
So before the Buddha practiced the ascetics way, he mm-hmm. already learned the 7 and the 8th level of jhana, right?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't that lead to his awakening, and why is like the knowledge or the recall of the jhana, the first jhana, enabled him to...
Okay. Of course, I can only speculate. But it's important to recognize there's always a distinction in the path between, say, right samadhi and wrong samadhi. Michha Samadhi and Samma Samadhi. So that even though there can be a realizing of all these different refined states of consciousness, if they're not grounded in right view, then they're not going to lead to the same result. So that for the Buddha, even though he was able to, say, concentrate the mind, focus the mind, realize even immaterial states of concentration, it came with an inherent tension or suffering in that one is just trying to annihilate the body, trying to annihilate the mind. So it came from attakilamata, that sense of it's a path of aversion, really, a path of and it might have, you know, he might have experienced some kind of well-being or relief when the mind is concentrated, but it didn't uproot the defilements. It didn't really come back and reflect on what's the root of suffering, what's the root of that inherent dissatisfaction within the human condition. So that the right concentration is also a concentration or a samadhi or a meditative state that is both mindful and alert and is also self-reflective, and as well as you know, being taking into account say these characteristics of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, not self.
So is it the practice of jhana and meditations is to build strength of the mind so that you'll be able to contemplate the Four Noble Truths?
Yeah, absolutely.
The final goal is to contemplate the Four Noble Truths and develop these passions rather than developing
I think it's important that they go hand in hand. You go together. I think there's a discourse where Ananda actually describes different pathways to liberation, and one is, say, that concentration first, insight later, insight first, concentration later, and then side by side or in tandem. And then there's another one that they've been arguing for over 2,500 years of what it is. I think that for most of us, I think it's important that we, especially if we've been most people that are here have been practicing at least for some time, and you're going to need to rely on both of those. The effort that you put into trying to reflect and investigate, and the effort that you put into trying to settle the mind, will help to support each other in developing a clear view of what is the way out of suffering. So it's relying on both of those. I don't think it's one or the other. Yeah, John.
When I learn more about the jhanas, they seem very foundational, very important to the practice, but yet it seems like Ajahn Chah was reluctant to talk about it. Is that a view that was pervasive amongst others?
There's one of the reasons is the amount of desire that is stimulated in terms of, you know, because you hear about it, man, I got to get those jhanas. You know, you know, so that there's an inherent problem, not with the jhana itself, but with the projection and the desire that the mind comes up with. So that, and there's subtle states of consciousness. So that, and they're not accessible to everybody, or they're not easy for everybody.
So if they're not accessible to everybody, I mean, I understand that, but you can still get far down the path without them.
Yeah, and I think it's also putting it in a, because sometimes when you approach it with desire, then it makes it even further away. So that you want to put it in a, you know, approach it in a way that you're optimizing your possibilities, or your, you know, you're optimizing your.
We're not all equal, so it makes sense that the whole range of what we're capable of achieving.
Yeah. So that, I mean, that's, you know, the other, you know, side of the coin is, of course, that whenever the Buddha defined right concentration in the Eightfold Path, it's always defined by the four jhanas. So it's not a small thing. But I think there's a a tendency to as I said, just in the human mind, and say, like Ajahn Jeff's teacher didn't talk about it that much. Ajahn Chah didn't talk about it. It's not that he didn't encourage the development of that, or that he himself didn't practice them, but it's a lot of it is how we conceive of it in our own mind, and how the sense of self gets entangled in it. That's kind of more the problem. Yeah.
I have a question about the Brahma Viharas, as has been my sort of tool use for the jhanas. And I sort of think that everyone's mind is different.
Yeah.
That to stop the mind with the Brahma Viharas, some people need to do.
Yeah, I think what that's, we didn't even get to that today. I think, coming back to the, how do you say, the recognition or recollection that, say, a jhana state is completely wholesome. And one of the more overt means of creating a completely wholesome state within the within our own minds or hearts is the lifting up and directing attention to Brahma Viharas, or to say the meditations on loving kindness and compassion.
And because I don't do it just on the cushion, because there's kind of this tyranny of the zafu that's going to happen, that those factors can get in alignment walking down a trail.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, as I say, it's much more dependent on the continuity of mindfulness and continuity of wholesome mental states. Those are the two. Because, I mean, you can sit on your cushion, and it's like Ajahn Chah says, you know, you can sit on your cushion for a long time. Chickens sit on, you know, they sit there for a long time. They don't get enlightened. Yeah.
What would you say to what might be the opposite perspective of instead of saying, oh, the Jhanas sound great, I got to get that
right
to a person such as me, who would say, well, those Jhanas seem like impossible to attain, so yeah, I'm just going to forget about it. Right. It doesn't apply to me, or it's like,
right,
you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that I would reevaluate in the sense of just that saying that say like a jhana experience is dependent on or relies on a continuity of mindfulness and a continuity of wholesome states, and you realize, okay, I'm capable of mindfulness, and I'm capable of good states of mind. And he says, "Oh, okay. You know, that's the encouragement." And of course, that's where vitakka and vichara, where one is rather, because oftentimes what we have a conception of me, the meditator, sitting there and making my mind go into jhana, whereas say vitakka and vichara just, you know, lifting up an object into the mind, whether it's lifting up the object in terms of the experience of the breath coming in, breath going out, lifting up the object of a recollection of loving kindness, a directing of loving kindness, a sustaining of loving kindness and compassion. There's a momentum begins to build of these sort of brighter, happier states of consciousness and of being, and the mind delights in that, and then it settles into it. That's your basis for jhana. Yeah, Neil.
Something that I think I just got today, after having heard about vitakka and vichara many times and have been defined and whatever,
yeah,
is that they're not exclusive to getting jhana.
No.
It's what we do all
if we
time.
Do all the time. Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Just finding an object.
It's not even. Yeah, we
and,
do, yeah.
And lifting it up and then observing.
Yeah,
it's, and then everything else that these steps that come after that yeah, we're talking about today
yeah,
aren't really anything we do.
Yeah.
It's once we do the vitakka and the vichara part,
yeah,
it arises.
Yes. Yes.
So
yeah,
there's nothing to go after.
Yeah. 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 Because often we conceive of it, then we go after it. We want to get it. We want to become it, and it's like running after our shadow, and it's always ahead of us. Yeah, Ying.
Before, so just following Neil's question, so I mean, if we all get it, and we have this wanting peace, this wanting mind, and that becomes doing something.
Yeah.
It's not
going. Yeah, but that's where you pay attention to the feeling. You pay attention to the feeling that arises. And when the feeling is generated by wanting, by craving, it's going to feel uncomfortable. It's going to be tight. It's going to be collapsing in on itself. Whereas that directing of attention to an object, being diligent, being interested, delighting in it. Maybe it's just a natural sort of relaxing, and you can feel it in the body. That's why I think it's important that those images of the body are so important, because you can keep coming back and you keep relaxing into that feeling and let it arise from that.
So,
yes, Dee.
Mindfulness of breathing, the Buddha says the breath is suffused throughout the body. You feel the breath throughout the body.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a similarity when you reach these higher states that suffusion throughout the body, so that starting with really getting the breath throughout the body is a good tool, a good way of...
Yeah, I mean, that's that, you know, it's just even like with mindfulness, you're like the four found, when the Buddha teaches the four, sutta on the four foundations of mindfulness, the very first thing that he teaches, when he teaches four foundations of mindfulness, is mindfulness of the breath and the body. That's the first four factors in the Anapanasati Sutta. And so that I mean, that's sort of telling, that's, to me anyway, or has, indicate something. So that sense of the, you know, the breath and the body being a strong basis for this cultivation of mindfulness. Kaushik, yes.
Is it that emphasis on the body is interesting? So when Ajahn asks about the one who knows.
Yeah.
Is that not a purely mental exercise either? Is that also embodied?
Well, the thing is there's a... I mean, there's a tendency to sort of... in our minds, and particularly from Western education, is a... and Western culture, is this division of mind and body. I think that this, when we speak of the one is, in a sense, it's an idiom. It's not a reality. You know, it's an idiom that's pointing to a particular quality. That's a being the one who knows. So it's not just trying to find some kind of separate experience that you can cordon off and not have to do anything else with anything, but you can just be the one who knows. Well, I mean, it doesn't really work that way. You have to have that quality of knowing. I mean, one, it's the way that the Thai Krupa Ajahn's, the Thai teachers, translate Buddha. This being the one who knows, so that it's knowing the mind, knowing the body, knowing the world that we're in, knowing the difference between liberation and suffering. I mean, it's the one who knows. So it's an idiom. It's not some kind of separate sort of thing that gets cordoned off, but it's a quality that we experience within the range of our experience of body, mind, world, self.
So that would include the other five sense bases.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, sort of that which knows. Okay. I think that's it for the day. I think it's been really fruitful. I don't know about anybody else. But, I think we could maybe dedicate the blessing, sharing of blessings, page 27. Now let us chant the verses of sharing and aspiration through the goodness that arises from my practice. May my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of Death. May those who are friendly, indifferent, or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless through the goodness that arises from my practice. And through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease, and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma.
The solitary Buddha is my noble lord.
The Dhamma is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and illusion be dispelled.